Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, a podcast for embedded Linux developers.
Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers. My name is Maciej Halasz. I'm one of the product managers here with TimeSys. With me here, I have Gene Sally. Gene.
Hi there. Gene, I work in the product group here at TimeSys, and I work on our webinars and some things that they like to call marketing, but I don't. Today we're going to talk about a little bit of embedded Linux history. We're going to take a walk down, or more appropriately, a run down memory lane, because there's a lot of stuff there I really don't want to remember. And then we're going to talk about what's going on today and what we see our customers doing with embedded Linux. And then we're going to guess a little bit about what we see coming down the pike. And one of the things I know we want to talk about, hopefully you'll believe this, but we do try to plan out our webinar, our podcast. But we do want to talk about some of the issues with host and target convergence, and how people are starting to do development on things that no one would ever dream of doing development on before.
Yep. So and that again evolved from 5 years ago till now, and surely it will keep on evolving. And but what we'll try to do today is just talk, as Gene said, about history of Linux a bit, projects to be specific, and then host and target convergence.
Yeah. Well, one of the big things, I guess, when I think about the 5 years ago, just a little bit of history for me is before I got involved with TimeSys, I'd never done anything embedded Linux ever. And so it was something new to me. And one of the things that we had to do here at TimeSys is we wanted to make sure that our customers had tool chains. And I know that the work that I had done before with cross-compiling were writing NLMs, Network Loadable Modules, and it never really popped into my head that I was following pretty much an embedded developer's path. But one of the things that sort of amazed me when you do NLM work is I'm now dating myself because this is way back in time, but you got a complete and ready tool set. It was ready. And I was on the other side of that, where I was actually getting the cross-compiler to compile, which was quite a dicey proposition at the time.
Don't you love that time when Linux 2.2 and a tool chain that you never knew whether it's going to work or not?
Yeah.
I hated that, to be honest.
Yeah, and what amazed me is that you didn't really think about this when you did stuff, but we had a lot of developers that purposefully did everything static. They compiled everything static because they could never really get the libraries to match up between their cross-compiler and their target device. And so their defense mechanism for that was, get rid of them.
5 years ago, to actually set up a host machine with all the right tool chains, set up the entire build environment if you wanted to rebuild the Linux kernel, that involved a lot of work and a lot of engineering time, and the outcome was really unpredictable. More than that, if you had a team that was really distributed across the world, you had to also face challenges of how do you take that build environment from your host machine and transfer that to another facility. There were always challenges around those tool chains, always challenges around building new programs, and as you said, matching the right set of libraries and all that.
Yeah, it was just sort of like blocking and tackling that really got you. And I mean, too, the other thing that we always got tripped up over earlier is that in Linux, not a lot of work had happened with respect to making the automake and autoconf scripts aware that they were even cross-compiling.
Yeah.
So you would run across issues where they would now it's less so. It's still a problem, but you would have issues where you didn't really have never check the config cache, and it would instead immediately try to compile something with the cross-compiler and run it on your current machine, and that was just. It almost made that kind of work impossible to do. We had customers initially that would go through, and they would have they would have a small PowerPC board, and they would say, "Well, yeah, I know it takes my program all night to compile, to configure, but it works."
Yeah.
And I've simply given up on ever getting that to work. Yeah.
5 years ago, not a lot of actual industry people were using Linux in their projects, and. Part of the reason behind it was that there were not that many embedded platforms that were enabled by Linux. And to get Linux up and running on a new board required a lot of knowledge around how to customize Linux. The code was, from a quality standpoint, in a completely different space that it is today. Well, again, as far as Linux kernel is concerned, 5 years ago, there were a lot of challenges and that prevented people from even getting into this space.
Oh, I agree. I know, pre 2.4, the Arch Directory was the Wild West. It really was, and it was very difficult in an organized fashion to get all those changes aggregated and maintained, and yeah, it was hard.
Not mentioning writing device drivers for custom devices, which, well, if you deal with an embedded board, embedded system, embedded project, is something that in most cases you can't avoid. Mm-hmm. And writing that under 2.2 Linux kernel was really a lot of work.
Yeah, it was a good test of your patience.
And your manager's patience. So let's talk about what happened since then, because I think that between 2.2 and 2.4 and now 2.6,
it's a different ballgame.
Exactly. So the customers that we see today are definitely a group of customers growing, and they come from various different industries. Linux gets more and more popular with each day. You see new projects starting with Linux rather than with other proprietary operating systems. So Linux has gone through a long way.
Yeah, and you see too the big rise of system on chips.
Yeah,
And what that means is that in order for the there's two things at the same time. First of all, it's the pull from the market for better Linux support, but you combine that with the system on chip, and the vendors really have no choice but to make sure that Linux is decently supported. And that doesn't, I know 5 years ago we spent time, Northbridge and Southbridge were common words, right? And now that's really something you don't hear about. I mean, a lot of those hardware problems have either been fixed and therefore exist in the kernel already and they're just built upon, or the company that makes the device is so concerned about Linux acceptance, where they weren't before, that they build in, or if they don't submit to the open source community, they make available to their users, patches and drivers for their particular system.
Yeah.
And given the architecture friendliness, it's a lot easier to publish those changes without doing other massive patches somewhere else.
Yeah, I agree that the responsibility for developing what I would call an enablement code for a specific system on chip is actually falling under a semi that manufactures that processor, and they do recognize that today. I believe, and they do have small teams that write that initial Linux code that drives their hardware components.
Yeah,
and that is crucial piece in getting both the hardware to the market and then getting a successful Linux project on that hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So companies like semis, specifically board vendors, do recognize the fact that Linux is a very important component in the go-to-market strategy. And they put more resources, more efforts in getting a better quality, better features, code for their system on chips.
Yeah. And then back over in in user land territory, something like cross-compiling or targeting a system other than the one you're working on is something that's not as esoteric as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think about Eclipse now has rudimentary cross-compilation support built into it. Kdevelop has rudimentary cross-compilation support in it. Things like AutoMake and AutoConf, I mean, those utilities as well have a lot more cognizance built into them with respect to at least detecting that you're cross-compiling.
Yeah.
And, as a result, that's taken a lot of the risk out once you at least get the kernel done. I mean, because before it was a fight to get the toolchain. And one of the benefits now is that because AutoMake and AutoConf are much friendlier, they now cross-compile a lot better.
Yep, I agree. Today you can have you can download so many toolchains that you can use right from the start. And you can focus on the value add that you want to develop with a kernel from provided by another company, root file system. Well, again, you have so many options today for the root file system, right? You can construct a small footprint root file system. You can construct the NFS mountable root file system and different compression formats available to people. That puts a lot of tools in engineers' hands, yeah, so that they can really make use out of Linux.
Yeah, and the BusyBox UC libc has really taken off like a shot as well.
Yeah.
I know initially when, BusyBox, this project's been around for, oh my goodness, like forever. No, it's been around for a while. But in terms of the support it has, I mean, it was a minimally viable root file system replacement, and now it's reasonable for you to have a desktop system that's running BusyBox. And then you pair that with UC libc, and that gets rid of a lot of the space issues. I have a lot of customers now that are that I work with that are completely, totally satisfied with what BusyBox applies. They pare it down a little bit, but because the way BusyBox is done, you could cut it in half, and half of something not very big is still not very big. So people, will just include everything.
That just actually shows how important to people is the size of the Linux solution that they work with.
Yeah.
And whether you work with a desktop like solution or very small, very embedded design, mm-hmm, well, BusyBox can come in very handy, and it's very easy to work with, very easy to configure, very, very easy to build upon.
Yeah.
And a lot of companies, they have a person that is responsible for building a basic root file system, and then they hand off that basic design to application developers, mm-hmm, who then add their new software libraries, utilities, applications on top of it, and working again with the BusyBox is one of the options.
Yeah, and I've seen too recently a very fast adoption of I think it was called TinyX. It was called TinyX for so long, I can't remember its real name. Since that's now been molded, folded into the standard X distribution.
Yes.
So it's it's reasonable for you to get a machine that has 8 meg on it, and run an X Windows, and a lot of that groundwork came out of some of the Linux based PDAs, because they'll use the same window managers that how to deal with input devices that aren't keyboards, and they're tuned to work with small real estate.
Yep.
And it's really been amazing in that respect. Because I know, if I see what's happened before, is Linux a lot of time was used for, I'm making quotes with my fingers, headless devices.
Yeah.
And now it's really reasonable to see a device with a reasonable UI on it.
Yeah.
And a stylus and whatever else.
That's actually a very, very good point, Gene, because the devices that we deal with today are, fairly advanced and compared to the ones from 5 years ago. And it's very normal today to work with a system on chip or a reference board that has a small footprint. I mean, the processor itself, but it also has an LCD device of some sorts, got a touch screen. When you work with Linux on that board, the question is, what are the packages, what are the utilities that are available to a developer that can help design the solution that will take advantage of all the components on that platform. And today, as you said, TinyX is one of the examples of packages that developers that is available to developers that can help out in designing a small footprint, yet very functional graphic UI. But there are more of those packages today. There is, actually, Micro Windows is probably a fairly old one.
Yeah.
But there is a number of commercial packages that are available.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I would point to a specific one, but there are options, which, again, is a proof that Linux is considered to be a very strong option when it comes down to selecting an operating system for a new project.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I've noticed too is, seeing the trends I see now is a lot more engineers are conceptualizing their target more like a remote Linux host. So they're getting a lot more comfortable with the idea that they don't have to build the entire installable image every time. And I'm going to knock that because that was a totally reasonable approach. But I mean, now it's really nice to see people that work on an embedded target like it's a remote host, and they'll download just their program and they'll let it up and running. And a lot of that has to come to the fact is that the target machines are now substantially more powerful.
Yeah.
Not relative to a desktop machine, but relative to where they were 5 years ago, it's totally reasonable to have a machine that has 8 meg of memory on it, which for an embedded device, that's a phenomenal amount of memory. So could run an SSH on it and just transfer down your program, and that could be your development board, and it's reasonable enough.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I was at a customer I was working with in Omaha, and I don't know if you're aware, but we're recording this in February, but Omaha got tons of snow, and I was chiding because we got tons of snow here. We can ski, and he's in Omaha, and it's flat as a tabletop there. So there's none of the advantages that we have. But he was looking at minimizing the amount of memory on his system, and the difference between a 4 meg and an 8 meg, in terms of the SIM and the components, was nearly nothing. I mean, it was literally cents. So it's very. We have customers out there and users out there that are really working with machines that they're beginning to view almost as, not as desktop machines, but viewing them as being able to run a lot of the things they would otherwise stick on a desktop anyway.
Yeah.
And a lot of them for the convenience of the developer.
Yeah. So I guess that takes us also to a topic of processes, because the way you were developing applications 5 years ago has changed over time, and today debugging an application on the target, you again have several options. You can use a cross debuggers, you can use several hardware debuggers that are connected to the embedded board directly. There are tools that are based on Eclipse technology that come in very handy that help in putting in place the entire development process for embedded platform.
Yeah,
and that is adding to developers' experience, because they are not concerned today that much about what it takes to set up a debug session if they work with certain processes. If they, for example, select to use a GDB server, there are different ways in which you can facilitate the entire debug session and the process they experience.
Yeah, and one of the nice things, that's a good point, because one of the nice things that's happening now is not only is cross-compiling tool chains easier, but it's easier to natively compile one as well. And so there are customers out there that may run the same pot of C code using the same version of their C library on their host machine, and it's reasonable for them to model out something on their host machine, and because they know they can get the same library on the target machine, sometimes people are doing a lot more testing and work and modeling right on their host, and instead of trying to go to the target and try to then remote debug it, and which is no matter how good your remote debugger is. It's always a remote debugger, right?
Right.
So there's all kinds of there's all kinds of problems that come in that territory.
Yeah, you have probably a limited number of embedded platforms that you can work with, and you have several developers that work on pieces of software that go on top of that. So if you debug your application, you don't want to be hauled back by another engineer that is that reserved the board or something, and you have to wait until that board is available to you again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it really does speed things. Yeah, because even here at Typus, we have lots of, more boards than you can imagine. And it always seems like there's never enough for everyone. And I can only imagine that problem is only more so at a commercial. I was at a customer first in California, and it was the same thing. I mean, you had engineers that were doing maintenance work, trying to fix bugs and whatever else, and they had trouble getting boards to do their testing on. It was just difficult for them to do, and they were one of the things they were kind of thrilled about is they could reasonably do a good job of knowing whether the software would work and at least finding defects on something similar to because they could get an environment that was close enough they could believe what they were seeing. and then
a lot of applications really don't care about the architecture that you run on, right? So you can build a specific application and run it on x86, and then cross compile it for your platform, and then just run some sort of regression testing whenever you get a hold of a target platform. But I agree with you 100% that the value of host-based development testing, quality assurance, has risen a lot.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. Maybe this actually was a good segue. But I know one of the things we want to talk about was some of this host thing we've been hitting on, this host and target convergence. But as much as we're talking about people that model and run, let's say, on their x86 machine, or if they're lucky, they're, you know, I guess it's still x86 if they have a Mac OS OS 10.
Let's not go there.
Anyway, so yeah, for the fortunate few. So, but the other folks that are doing work, we've also seen a decent set of people that simply do all their work right on the target. And I first saw this with some of the higher end PowerPC boards.
Yeah.
And the user would say, hey, you know, nuts on the cross compiling.
Yeah.
It's interesting, thank you, but I'm just going to do my development right here on the board.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's reasonable, fast enough. I can run make an Emacs and, you know, my compiler, and I have, you know, 64 meg here. And as a matter of fact, because I have one of those serial ATA drives, it's faster than my desktop for compile sometimes. And that's also a trend that's coming out there.
So I would say that if you have a powerful enough platform that, you know, can handle the compilation fairly fast, and you don't have to share that board with too many engineers on your team, that's a perfectly good solution, because, well, building natively was always a better approach, right? Let me put it this way, less complex. You didn't have to worry about the cross-compilation issues. But again, if you have that luxury of having a fast board and having it sitting close to your desk, and if you can take advantage of it, absolutely. PowerPCs are probably in that area, I mean, of boards that are powerful enough to provide end users with good native compilation experience.
Yeah, I was humored to know it, because what he would do is, this guy, this particular customer, is they would have their PowerPC board, and he'd SSH in, and then he'd say, you know, export display, and he'd export the display out to his, and then he'd crank up
PowerPC, PowerPC display?
Yeah, so he'd export to this export, and then he'd set up his, you know, his whatever desktop machine.
Yep.
And then, you know, of course, once you start Emacs, what else do you need to start?
Exactly.
So he would open up a shell in his editor and do his makes, and he was amazingly productive that way. But I've seen a lot of other customers take pretty much the same route now, you know, with little x86, well, they're little, but then the mini ATX sort of boards, because that's another thing. The price point for those is $80, $90, $50 if you get something low power, where low power was a desktop a couple years ago.
Yep.
And same thing, they'll plug it on their desk, and voila.
Yeah, there are a lot of ARM processors that are very popular on the market today, and unfortunately, not all of the ARM solutions are powerful enough to provide you with a good native compilation experience. Yeah. So my experience with customers in that space was always that they were choosing the cross-compilation and host machine, for a number of them, they were actually building an application that was architecture independent. But for those that were building architecture dependent code, they had to go through that process of getting, you know, a cross-compiled application, uploaded it to a target, and then they were in the process of course debugging it. Again, their experience, as they described it to me, was what I would call kind of like a good experience in compared to what I've experienced in the past. The questions that people raise today in that process is, why is it taking so long? But as long as the process itself and the ease of getting through that process is concerned, there are a lot of improvements.
Yeah, I know one of the other points I wanted to bring up was, you know, the people that do the Development Native on their board, one of the things, and I don't mean this to be a shameless plug for whatever, one of the things they really like about the tool chains they got from us is that when we built them all against the same sources.
Yep.
Because what their manager, they get in these things with their managers, and the manager's like, well, it has to build in the build system, and there's mumble, on and on. And one of the nifty things that they liked is that they could take their source code and they could build it against a cross-compiler that they knew was was building against the same sources as what they were running natively.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, it was like, oh, fantastic. I can do my work right on the board.
Yeah.
And I have 100% confidence that when I have it cross-compiled, I'm still going to get the same thing.
Yeah, that was a good call on our end to basically use the same set of sources for all different compilers that we provide for different platforms.
Yeah. So we're getting the hand signal that we're running short on time. And but I know we had a few things we wanted to talk about because we got more than I expected, actually. People email us at podcast@timesys.com. And so if you have any questions or comments, or you want to tell us that we bore the death out of you for half an hour, or you want to know something about Linux, you know, just drop us a line, podcast@timesys.com.
If you don't mind, if you have any ideas, or if you would like to hear about specific topics, please let us know. We are very much open to what you would like to hear about, and we'll do all we can to put together a podcast that would interest you the most.
Yeah, it really is. This is the point. I mean, this is kind of fun for me to do, right? But if it's not a value to the listener, or we're not addressing things that you as a listener are interested in, tell us, and we most certainly will.
So on that note, we actually got several questions, right?
Yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, we got one of them we talked about a little bit. This is from Amit, and he was really focused on root file system minimization. I know a little bit back and forth, but when we talked about this, when we were getting prepped for these meetings, we thought it was like, wow, we should probably just make a podcast on one of those. But in general, there's a lot of different strategies. I know we talked about some of them during this, and that was use a small library, use something like BusyBox. But then at the same time, also look at different file systems that will compress your data.
Yeah, I agree with you. We can talk probably about root file system, different types of root file systems, and customer selection experiences for several hours.
Yeah.
In general, what we observe is BusyBox based solutions where you select just a handful of packages that are really important to your solution, and then you try to minimize not only a root file system, but also you want to remove unneeded device drivers from your kernel, just so that you really work with all components that are small.
Well, I know we have two separate webinars about that. We have one webinar. One's about small systems, small things for root file system land, mm-hmm. and another one is about minimizing your root file system and different approaches. And it also covers all the different file systems that are out there and how you can use those in order to get a substantially smaller root file system by getting rid of things that you wouldn't otherwise be using. So
if that's not, I guess, enough of an answer, we would like to invite the person that asked this question to our future podcast on root file systems, so stay tuned.
Yeah, we'll get it right for that. I mean, but that's a great thing.
Yeah, the second question that we got was from Steve, I believe, and Steve's question was, where can I get boards for my project? Well, depending on type of board that you would like to work with, mm-hmm. and your budget and your specific needs, you can probably get boards from semis directly. They do sell reference boards. You can try and get boards from channel sales. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of companies here in the U.S. and there are a lot of companies around the world that, basically serve as a sales channel to different semi vendors and board vendors. You can also get boards directly from board vendors. As far as types of boards, well, in LinuxLink, you can find or LLDN, LinuxLink Developer Network, you can find a description of boards that we work with, a bit more info on peripherals that you can find on those boards. But we'll have podcasts as well about new boards that we introduce. So we'll spend a bit more time talking about details of new boards.
Yeah, searching, just, you know, go to your search, your favorite search engine, and search for a mini ITX. And you'll, that'll turn up a lot of boards.
Yeah.
That, you know, small x86-based, you know, 686-based boards that, you know, Pentium 2s, 3s, they're fantastic for embedded development. And there are also, in general, don't try to mention things by brand name, but there are also some small ARM boards as well, you know, that are, you know, the size of
PDA.
You know, a small calculator.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll have an interface on them for the network and USB. And those are, I mean, they'll start up, and they're perfectly fine. They're perfectly fine things to experiment with, and you can get those for under $100 as well.
Yeah.
But I know the mini ITX boards, is that if you scan around, if you want to live with a 586 board to experiment with, I mean, that's a
very
expensive proposition.
I agree with you that starting with, if you can start with an x86 platform, that's by far the most economic approach to just have the first experience with embedded board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but otherwise, it's, you know, get in touch with a company that really does embedded development.
Yeah.
I know, like, one of our partners, Atmel, does a lot of, you know, design work. They'll help a customer. They may have a development board, which is, you know, the everything plus the kitchen sink and a bathroom sink, and, you know, more than you can imagine. But they'll also help you make a custom board as well, so you can have you know, through whatever sort of resellers that they have. But, I mean, they'll help you figure out, you know, what you need in order to have a exactly what you're looking for if you're going the high volume route. Low volume route, there's probably some other things for you to choose from to get started with. So I think that's what we wanted to cover for today. I think we all wrapped up.
I think so. I don't think that we have any more time left. I see here, like, signals that we are reaching our time limit.
Yeah, what does finger cross the neck mean? Switching back and forth. What is that? I'm not exactly sure what that means. So, but I know our next episode, we're going to start talking about getting a host environment set up, and we have a lot of, I mean, it's one of the first things people do, right? So they get Linux, and they figure, oh, I'm going to get my host environment set up and running, and then, well, sometimes they run into problems. And so we're going to talk about some of the problems you run across and how to fix them. A lot of them are along the lines of system administration issues. I mean, really what they would boil down to. But at the same time, we can talk to you about environments that we know are very successful for users. And, you know, if you're going to get something like that set up, what's the least amount of effort in order for you to get a board up and running?
Yep. So thank you very much for your attention today. We're looking forward to reaching you out with our next podcast in 2 weeks. Yeah. But meanwhile, if you have any questions or comments or any kind of feedback, please contact us at podcast@timesys.com. Visit our website. Send us your questions, comments, and we're here to provide the best answers we can.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you. So thanks, and see you again.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Check out our new site to get free code, discuss, and learn about embedded Linux development. Go to timesys.com today.